by far the hardest year of my career. And I mean, one of the hardest years of my life. And you just never know, you know, like you never know what's going to happen. So in the years after that year, I retired. I raced domestically. I retired from World Cups, raced domestically, retired from racing a year ago. And I have been mining and excavating that experience from that year and speaking about it. Like the amount of learning that I took away from that, I mean, some could see it as a giant failure, right? Like in all, if you want to define it like that, it was a failure. Really, I failed to make the Olympic team. And what I have taken away from that and what I've learned and then gone on to essentially start my next career is speaking about that year. And so it was also a gift.
That's two-time Olympian and eight-time national champion mountain biking superstar Leah Davison, describing how the devastation of not qualifying for what would have been her last shot at the Olympic Games has proven more valuable than she could have imagined. Today, Leah shares her story with unflinching honesty, from the euphoric highs to the very raw heartbreaks she navigated throughout her career. We talk about her path to publicly coming out as a gay athlete and how she's embracing her chance to become the role model she always needed. You're listening to the Be a Good Wheel podcast, the show where we explore what it means to be a good wheel by digging into scientific research and personal stories about human potential and performance. I'm your host, Amber Pierce. Hailing from Jericho, Vermont, Leah's athletic journey included cross-country running, swimming, and even windsurfing, instilling a wholehearted appreciation for sport. Her Olympic dreams, however, initially took shape on the ski slopes with dreams of qualifying for the Winter Games and downhill ski racing. In high school, just when that dream began to seem out of reach, she discovered mountain biking. And the rest, as they say, is history. She would go on to carve out one of the most celebrated and impactful careers in American mountain biking, but not before graduating from Middlebury College, one of the most competitive and highly ranked colleges in the United States. Her mountain biking career spanned over two decades, starting in 2001, when she won a junior national race in Vermont, unintentionally qualifying for the World Championships. She formally announced her retirement in February of 2022. By then, she had earned eight national championship titles, silver and bronze World Championship medals, and had represented the United States in both the London and Rio Olympic Games. Leah knows what it takes to compete at the highest level, yet perhaps even more impressive than her accolades on the race course is Leah's commitment to giving back to the sport she loves. In the run-up to the Tokyo Games, her final chance to qualify for and medal at the Olympics, she committed herself to helping her compatriots earn results that would help them qualify for the Games, knowing even then that not all of them would make the team, and that she could be helping someone else take her spot. It's a beautiful story we get to hear in this episode. She and her sister Sabra, also a mountain biking phenom and Middlebury graduate, co-founded Little Bellas, a mentoring program aimed at empowering young girls through cycling. And Leah has become a role model and advocate for women and LGBTQ athletes, leveraging her personal experiences to make things better for athletes coming up in the sport. Leah is not only shaping the future of mountain biking, but also fostering a community built on empowerment, camaraderie, and the sheer joy of riding. Today, we'll be delving into Leah's journey, from her early days on the trails to the heights of Olympic competition. We'll explore her mindset as a competitor, her passion for mentorship, the challenges she's faced as a gay woman in sport, and what she has planned for the future. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Be a Good Wheel podcast. It is my absolute pleasure today to introduce to you a two-time Olympian, Leah Davison. She's here with us today. Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Me too. So one of the questions I love to ask people is, what was the moment? If you remember the moment, or maybe it was more of a process, but do you recall what it was that really kind of drew you to the bike or made you know that like, this is for me, this is my thing?
Yeah. Yeah, there actually was a moment. So I was in high school. And I was either junior or senior, and Dan Dombrowski, who was actually my boyfriend at the time, he was like, hey, why don't you stop running around in circles on the track? Because that's what I would do in the spring, and like come try out this mountain biking thing. So this was like pre-NICA, but our high school had a mountain bike club, actually. And we like raced against other local high school mountain bike clubs. I think there were like two. And that's when I first discovered mountain biking. And at the time I was running cross country in high school. And then I was also downhill ski racing. So it's two very different sports. And I felt like mountain biking was the perfect combination of both of them. And we did some local races. And then we went to Mount Snow, which was a national race, a Norba National at the time. And then also West Virginia at Snowshoe, actually, West Virginia. So that was the first time I've been to those venues. And I won one of those junior races, and a official came up to me from USA Cycling. They said, hey, you won this race. You've just qualified for Worlds. And I was like, what? there's a Worlds for this? Like, there's a World Championships. And over that weekend, I watched the pro women race, and I saw that, oh, you can be a pro. You can make a living. There's a World Championships for this. And then there's also an Olympics. And I thought, this is it. Like, this is my ticket. This is what I'm doing. And because, you know, in the years prior to that, I always had this Olympic dream, and I was trying to make it happen on skis, actually. Mm-hmm. So yeah, from that moment on, I'm like, I am doing this. This is what I'm doing.
That's amazing. What was it? So you said you felt like it was the perfect combination of running and skiing. How can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. Running, you know, I learned through a phenomenal coach and team that I was on how to push my limits. So That's very key, as you know, in endurance sports. And then the downhill ski racing really gave me, it feels similar to mountain biking, actually, like, and cycling in general, like cornering feels like arcing on skis. You're looking ahead, you're looking for a line. So a lot of those skills that I had been working on for a long time in ski racing kind of came into play also on the mountain bike.
Interesting. I love that. So it was kind of that like endurance, pushing the limits of your physical endurance with the skill set of reading lines and having to do that at very high speeds.
Yeah.
Very and technical terrain.
Amber, this is a fun fact. So
yes,
I ran in high school with Aaron Sullivan, who won the Foot Locker National Championships for running. And that's how I learned how to push my limits. I mean, my coach was like, you stick with Aaron on these intervals for as long as you can. And I was like, no, I can't do that. And she's like, no, just stick with her for as long as you can. And on that day, I learned that I could go harder and longer than previous. And Erin, when she graduated from Mount Mansfield High School, went on to run for Stanford.
No way.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Such a small world. So
totally.
That, I think we have a few questions here that we've talked about and discussed, but you know, we'll definitely jump around a little bit. And you just described such a perfect example of how competition can really bring out the best in you.
Yes.
And sometimes competition gets a bit of a bad rap as a zero-sum game and being really cutthroat.
Yeah.
But what you described, you know, trying to keep up with Aaron helped you discover, you know, some strength and endurance that you didn't necessarily know that you had prior to trying to keep up with her. And this has been something that you have talked really passionately about in your career, and I love this, is that sense of collaborative competition or competitive collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. Same concept.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about that, because you've got some really great examples of your career of this.
Yeah. Thanks so much for bringing that up. And you just described it really beautifully, actually. I mean, I've never looked at it from the nuance of like competition getting a bad rap. And like, and you're right, especially in an individual sport, it's like, every woman for themselves, like, I'm going to do this all or nothing. You know, like, there's so much language out there of like, I'm going to crush you. And that's the only way. And we can't be friends, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not a connecting experience. In fact, it's like it's a divisive experience.
Yes.
And so, yeah, competitive collaboration is kind of turning that idea on its head, especially in an individual sport like mountain biking. And it's approaching the sport as a team. And so it's like, wait a second, actually, if we're spending all of our time racing each other, right? I'm just talking about the American women, for example. Mm-hmm. So like, I'm fighting you for an Olympic spot. So I'm going to like keep all these secrets and we're not going to ride together and I'm going to beat you in this race. And it's like, wait a second. We have the entire world to race against. So actually we have plenty of competition out there. So why not use each other as more of a source of information and support and a way to make each other better, essentially. Yeah. So let's work together on the course pre-rides. Let's ride with each other. Let's, you know, if Kate's, for example, I was teammates with Kate Courtney for a while and specialized. So her being a younger rider, her strength was just like sending it. You know, I'm going to send it off these drops. I'm going to send it off these jumps and not so much gosh. Right? So I was more of like my strength was the technical, like on the ground, rock gardens and like slippery stuff.
Yeah.
And so she would lead me off of these drops that I wasn't feeling that comfortable on. And then I would lead her down these like technical rock gardens. And that is part of competitive collaboration. And it's like, yeah, it's actually, I think, all of the best of competition.
I love that. And you guys did this in a really organized manner leading up to the Rio Olympics, right? You called it, what was it, Team US Sleigh?
Yes, that was actually Kate's term. She came up with that.
That's so good.
This was leading up to Tokyo because...
Tokyo,
right. Yeah, Tokyo for the first time, you know, in history, historically, the top ranked 8 nations got 2 spots. And then for the women and the mm-hmm. men, of course, got 3 spots. And
of course,
they made it equal for the Tokyo Olympics. So the top 2 ranked nations got 3 spots and then going down 2 spots and then 1 spot. Mm-hmm. And so it was, yeah, it was a solution to a challenge, right? It was like better for everybody if we had more spots, because if we have 3 spots, I'm more likely to qualify, right?
Right.
And so it created this team dynamic a little bit, which was already there because Aaron Huck, Chloe Woodruff, and myself were all privateers. And then we would travel with USA Cycling and USA Cycling would become our trade team for the World Cups. And so we were already Team US Sleigh, you know, like we had the foundation there. And we were very intentional about, hey, how are we going to work together to get enough points to be ranked top 2 in the world and get 3 Olympic spots?
Yeah, I love this. So just to clarify that, when Leah talks about being a privateer, this is you're putting together your own suite of sponsors. You weren't necessarily part of an established professional team. And that was kind of putting together your financial and equipment package for the season. And then USA Cycling functioning as a trade team is sort of like the national team stepped in to provide the support that a professional team typically would in that situation.
Yeah, at the races. So Swan Year, that's a massage therapist, helps with feeding, mechanic, vans, like all the infrastructure of a team and the personnel that you need to succeed at the highest level.
Yeah, I love this because on the face of it, you would think that if each person was acting in their own self-interest, you know, everybody wants one of those Olympic berths. But what you were able to do as a group is to identify that you all had this one common interest, which was to have as many spots open for the Olympics as possible and to work together around that common interest. I just think that's such a beautiful thing.
And yes, it is beautiful. It definitely was beautiful. And I don't think it's often been done. You know,
and
you hear little snippets and stories here and there about running and like Shalane Flanagan and her, you know, lift as you rise. And so you have like, in simple terms, like a friend group and a posse when you make it to the top. You know, it doesn't have to be lonely at the top.
Exactly. I do think that it happens, but it's not something that we talk enough about because, you know, I do think that there's so much, as you put it, rhetoric that makes competition sound, or it frames competition as being so divisive and, you know, maybe negative, but like just really hardcore and not exactly what you would think of as being collaborative.
Yes. It's the opposite.
It can be. But then at the same time, like I do think, you know, especially in the example that you're giving with Team USA, not only are you working toward a common interest, but in doing so, you're making each other better. So no matter what happens or who gets selected, you all come out of that experience as better athletes than you would have.
Yeah.
Had you, as you put it, kind of like hunkered down, looked after yourself, not shared information, not challenged each other, not helped each other.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that was the case for you? Did you come out of that better than you think you would have otherwise?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I am an extrovert, so I thrive with interacting with others, you know, and we're all different, right? So Chloe, a little bit more introverted, and she's still, you know, she was still all in on this teamwork. And the whole concept behind competitive collaboration is you bring your best, I'll bring my best, and together we will rise.
I love that.
So this is not like a, oh, you know, I want you to go easier because you're better than me, right? So like, take it easy on me. It's like, no, bring it.
Yes.
Because I want to know how I stack up against you.
Yes.
That's like an honest take. And from that knowledge, I'll know how I can get better. Like, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? And the other major side benefit that I found through the whole Tokyo process of qualification is when you work together and truly help each other, you can celebrate each other's victories. And you can, because you can own like a very small part of that person's win. And that is way more fun than being devastated, right? Like, of course you want to win. Of course your heart breaks. And you know that a piece of you is there in that win. So when I got injured and I didn't end up getting selected for Tokyo, this came in big time for me because I felt like I was part of my teammates who were competing in Tokyo, you know, and I was represented and part of that process. So that was a small, I don't even want to say silver lining because the whole thing was devastating and heartbreaking, but it was a little bit of a salve, you know, on that like aching heart.
And devastating and heartbreaking in the sense, and just specifically because you didn't get to make that team.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Tokyo, you know, I had competed in London. I came in 11th. I competed in Rio Olympics 2016. I came in 7th. And so I felt like Tokyo, I knew my heart, like that was kind of my last shot. And I was on this great progression to medal, right? Like it was like, okay, well, let's just minus those places.
Pretty clear trajectory.
Yeah. And sport, as we all know, is not that simple, right? Mm-hmm. And injuries happen. And I'm grateful. Well, I'm grateful that I got to compete in those two Olympics. And I'm proud of those results. It's taken a while to get there. You know, it was always my dream to win an Olympic medal. And these are these things that I've aimed for since I was a kid, right? So it's heartbreaking to miss out on that opportunity.
Yeah. No, this was a story that you ended up sharing in a Moth style talk that you delivered at Middlebury. And I got to listen to that. And if anybody who's listening, I will link it in the show notes. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece, Leah. But do you mind sharing a little bit of that story here?
Yeah, sure. I can definitely share it.
Love it.
Share it in front of an audience now. So, and gave it life and an air. So yeah, that story that I told at Middlebury was a story that I've never told, not to anyone really that knew the full extent, not even my parents, that my coach that came to that that Moss story that I gave knew the full extent. I mean, really, the only one that knew was Fraser, my wife, because she lived this experience alongside me.
Yeah.
So that was a really powerful thing to tell that story. And it felt like a good moment to do that. So the story is that a little bit what I touched on, right? I'm on this natural progression and I finish the Rio Olympics in seventh. And before Rio, I was a medal favorite because I had won a silver world championship medal racing against all the same women a month prior to the Rio Olympics. So being a medal favorite, you know, that's all the media and anyone can talk about. The pressure is very high. And so I crossed that line. It didn't work out on that day. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to have an absolutely phenomenal day. And it's one day out of all the days.
Yeah. So that's such a harsh truth.
It is. Yeah. And you train a lifetime for this moment. And sometimes, yeah, it's you're not having a good day. So, I mean, I still did have a good day, but you need to have a phenomenal day to win an Olympic medal. So I crossed that line in seventh. And at that time, I was disappointed, you know, like you walk through the media mix zone, you see all these women who you've beat before, you know, getting interviewed by the press. And it took me a while to kind of like wake up from that moment and that disappointment and go, okay, wait, I still have 4 years to make it happen. Like, let's go, you know? Yeah. And so fast forward 4 years, I'm raging going into 2020. And we all know what happened then. Pandemic happened. And so the Olympics got postponed. And I really think that didn't favor the older athletes. It favored the younger ones because we're just like, hanging on by a thread.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Like, okay, I have, you know I have this much more hard work left in me and it takes a lot to like bring yourself up for all that hard training. So
yeah,
naturally I got an espresso machine. That was the deal.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So you got an espresso machine, which is like just the most like poetic response to this.
I know. If the Olympics are going to be postponed, I need some caffeine to get through this extra year of hard work. And I never drank caffeine or coffee before.
Oh my gosh.
Now, avid coffee drinker.
Okay.
So that was a great training tool.
Major life shift. Major life shift.
Yes. Yes.
Welcome to the dark side, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, it's so wonderful. So much more fun. So yeah, I trained very hard, raced on Zwift, like was still so fit because I wasn't traveling.
Oh,
so I could just put in these giant training blocks and still get that racing effort on Zwift where I did like the women's Tour de France, like virtually, and I was doing all these crazy races. So I entered the 2021 season, like, all right, let's go. Like I'm psyched. And literally the first day of training where I was lifting and doing a hex bar squat, like I've done millions of times and I feel like something happened to my back and I'm like, oh my God. Oh no. Mm. Like I just knew I'm like, everything needs to line up perfectly to make an Olympic dream come true. And this is not good.
Yeah.
And I still have time. It's November. So here we go. Mm-hmm. Like, let's assemble the squad, strength coach, everybody. And then I'm training. I go down to Asheville, North Carolina. It's snowing Vermont where I live. And I'm putting in another big training block, huge. And it was like 7 days in a row, really pushing my limits. And I'm carrying my bike up the stairs. This is like end of December. Mm-hmm. And I'm carrying my bike up the stairs and it happens again.
Oh.
And this time worse. Like I like collapse.
Oh,
on my hands and knees, and I'm just sobbing like uncontrollably because I know, like, okay, now I'm really screwed. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost January and this is really not good because I really did something. So, I just threw the kitchen sink at it. I mean, that's all. I was like, I have to do everything in my power to try to get selected for this team. Yeah. Because if I do anything less than that, I'm not going to be able to sleep at night. 100%. Right? It's just like, do everything that I can to heal from this and get training and show up at that, you know, those first two World Cups in the best shape that I can, given the circumstances.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I mean, I showed up at that start line and I never gave up through the whole process. And I gave it my all. I did the best I could. You know, it was a far cry from what I can do when I'm healthy.
Yeah.
And I didn't get selected for the team. Oh, so, brutal. Yeah, just, it's devastating. I mean, it's really devastating. And then I thought, you know, once that, it's hard to talk about.
Oh, I mean,
how do you put it in words, right? That devastation. It was really a moment for me when I got that email, because it, like, you know, salt in the wound, it ranked us riders, the riders on the Olympic long team, you know, said like a little blurb about us. And it said two things. One was pretty much Leah's legacy has paved the way for, you know, future generations to experience success in this sport. And she's over the hill, you know, like she doesn't have it anymore. And so naturally, I mean, that's a very nice thing to say, to like give a nod and acknowledgement at like the trail I've paved.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like I've blazed. And you know, naturally I was pissed. And yeah, that kind of, my reaction was like, nope. They don't get to define me.
Yeah.
Like, and a lot of expletives. And like, I define me. Like, selection committee, you have no idea what I'm capable of. No idea. And so then I was, from that moment on, I was like on a mission to like define myself in my career. These people don't know me. Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to define what I was capable of. So yeah, that's what I spent the rest of the season doing. And it did not go well until it did.
I want to just dig into that for a second. So
yeah,
that
there's
reaction,
a lot to dig into.
There's a lot there. I mean, there are some layers here, right? And again, folks, if you haven't already seen this, please check out Leah's talk. It's shockingly beautiful. Like, it's a just shock to the soul. It's so good.
Oh, thanks, Amber.
But I am just in awe of the fortitude, like just the emotional and like soul level fortitude that it took for you to say, you don't define me, I define me.
Yeah.
Do you think you could have done that or had that reaction in the beginning of your career? Is that kind of the level of self-assurance that you had, that you've always had? Or is that something that you think evolved?
That is such a good question. I mean, I definitely think it evolved naturally, because when we're young, we don't have that confidence. You know, you're like kind of looking forward and grappling with it. And it is something that I always knew. Like, I had faith that it would work out, because I'm just talking about like success in my career and making it to the next level, because for one, I'm stubborn and I'm determined. And also, like, I have this deeply held belief that that year definitely challenged, but that hard work pays off. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, this has to pay off. Like, I have put so much hard work into this. So let's stick with it to see it pay off, because if I don't, I'm going to regret it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as simple as that. Like, I wanted no regrets in terms of like the buildup to that Olympic selection. And then afterwards, I didn't want any regrets of how I left my World Cup racing career, you know? Like, I knew I had it in me. So I don't know if that answers your question, but like,
I think it does.
I think it's something that develops for sure.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I know for me early on in my career, I remember very clearly just like constantly looking outside of myself for that validation, you know,
always.
Like I wanted to find the coach that was going to tell me I could make it, you know, or I wanted to find the team with the director who was finally going to believe in me. Mm-hmm. And by the end of my career, I realized like, oh, it's the classic, like, it was with you all along.
Yeah. God. It's like a Hallmark movie, but it's
right,
true.
But it's true. But I love, like, I got goosebumps when you were describing that, just the conviction in your voice. Like, you could just tell in your bones, you're like, I am walking away from this on my terms. And
yeah,
like you said, actually, in one of the interviews I did with Elliot Jackson, he was like, sports are like the least deterministic thing. And it's so true. As much as hard work matters, there's so much that's beyond our control.
Yes.
And you were able to say, okay, this thing's not in my control, but you know what is? How I walk away and what I do with this. And I just think that I just get goosebumps about that. That's so powerful.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, I mean, thank you. I really appreciate that. Very kind words. And the interesting thing is this was by far the hardest year of my career. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of the hardest years of my life. And you just never know, you know, like you never know what's going to happen. So in the years after that year, I retired, I raced domestically, I retired from World Cups, raced domestically, retired from racing a year ago. And I have been mining and excavating that experience from that year and speaking about it. Oh. Like the amount of learning that I took away from that, I mean, some could see it as a giant failure,
right? Yeah. Like
in all, if you want to define it like that, it was a failure. Really, I failed to make the Olympic team. And what I have taken away from that and what I've learned and then gone on to essentially start my next career is speaking about that year.
Yeah.
And so it was also a gift. In a lot of ways. But did it feel like that at the time? Absolutely not. Does it feel like that all the time still? No. I mean, no.
Yeah.
There's still moments. I mean, I'm still excavating, you know?
Well, let's talk about that part of taking the reins and walking away on your own terms, because this did have a pretty amazingly uplifting kind of ending to that year.
Yeah. It was the year of resilience. I mean, you would think like, okay, universe, like throw me a bone.
Yeah, right.
I like didn't get selected for the Olympic team. And here I am still out here racing. So like, can you please make it work out? And no, you know, like the first World Cup after that selection was made, I showed up and I raced and I got lapped and pulled from a World Cup. Like the last time that that had happened was 20 years ago in the beginning of my career. Because I had the wrong tires on, it was super muddy, blah, blah, blah. And then, okay, here I go. I'm feeling better. I'm finally feeling fit. I go and do this warm-up race before like the next, before World Champs. And I'm like, this is it. You know, like I'm going to medal at World Champs. It's going to be awesome. And then I get in this major crash in this warm-up race in Switzerland. I fall on my face. I am worried about having a concussion because when you hit your face, side note, you probably have a concussion.
Yeah.
And so I sit out World Champs. And then, so I can do these races after World Champs, you know, like, so I can maybe have a race that I know I'm capable of.
Yeah.
And at the next race in Lenzerheide, it was going well. And then I literally crashed off of a bridge. You know, like, you cannot make this up. And I like crash and I get like, I fall on this stump and I essentially get punched, like an uppercut punch to the chin by this stump.
Oh my gosh.
And then I'm like, oh my God, do I have another concussion? You know, like, I just got, but I finished that race and I had like a pretty solid result. Like, I was in the top 20. So things were looking better, but did that go perfectly? No, it was like still rocky.
You got punched and by a tree. Like,
I know. It's like, really? I mean, I just kept being like, are you serious? Like, can anything work out? And so it came down to the last World Cup of the season in West Virginia on home soil. And I'm like, please, 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 please. I'm just like desperate to have this race that I know I can have.
Yeah.
And I do, you know, I start, thankfully I'm on, this was in my favor. I was on the right side instead of the left. There was a huge crash on the left.
Oh, man.
I'm like, woo-hoo! And I spend most of that race in the top 10 and as the first American. And it was just such a beautiful experience because I was the first American racing in front of a home crowd. I mean, everyone is like losing their mind and cheering. It gives me goosebumps. And I spend the majority of the race with Yolanda Neff on my wheel, like hanging onto my wheel for dear life until the last lap, which she does a classic Yolanda and passes me on the downhill. It drops me. So, and Yolanda, I crossed that finish line and I kind of realized like, oh my gosh, Yolanda won the gold medal, the Olympic gold medal in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And so it was just this beautiful moment of like, yeah, if things were like a little bit different, I can be in the mix, like, and I could have been in the mix in Tokyo. So I'm not saying, I mean, of course, everything has to line up for a gold medal and Yolanda is one of the best of all time.
Yeah.
And it just provided this like very nice full circle closure moment that I needed. Like I needed that for me to have that race. And Yolanda and like being the first American on home soil, that was like the cherry on top. And I didn't know it at the time, but that was my last World Cup race. Mm. So, and they announced it as my last World Cup race, even though
you hadn't announced it.
I hadn't announced it, but they thought I made some kind of announcement, but I'm glad that they did because it almost gave me that like send off. You know, that send off race that I wanted. So it was just, it was beautiful.
Well, it's a perfect expression of exactly what you said when you got that email telling you that you hadn't made the Olympic team. Like, I know what I'm capable of. And you got the opportunity to fully express that on the bike.
Yes. Thank goodness. Thank goodness that worked out. Because I don't know if I could have lasted for another year of training for the World Cup.
How did you get, you know, those first few races afterwards where you were having this terrible luck race after race? You know, I just find it so impressive that, you know, you get the devastating news about the Olympics and then you have these really like just like terrible luck races back to back. I mean, again, the fortitude that it took to not just say, okay, maybe the universe is trying to tell me something, like, and say, no, I know this is still in me.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I mean, I think it was two things, like desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was desperate, like to show up and have the race that I knew I could have. And I learned through that experience, like the only way through is directly through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the only way through the heartbreak and this devastation of not making the Olympic team and all these feelings is straight through it. Like, that's it. Like, they're only going to grow, these feelings, if you like push them away and you build up walls. And it's like, and that took me, you know, in the middle of an interval set, like pulling over and crying, like breaking down in tears. in the middle of an interval set, like on a random dirt road in Vermont. And it's like, yep, okay, I need to feel this. Like, this is grief. Oh, it's grief of an Olympic dream. And so it pops up at some weird times. And let me tell you, crying in intervals do not work.
It does really make it hard, doesn't it? Like, yes. I've had some moments on the side of the road myself. And yeah, it is, it doesn't make for a great workout.
So it's like, okay, let's pull over, let's cry it out, and then let's finish the set. Like, let's go.
Well, this is such a great illustration of something I think is really important because, again, one of the things that I came to the sport believing was that, oh, the best performers in the world are the best because they can just compartmentalize or they figured out how to not have these problems or, you know, they're superhuman in a way that they can like work around this somehow. And I thought that there was something wrong with me, that I was, you know, having these emotions and struggling with these things. And the longer I'm in the sport and I'm around other athletes, I realize like, oh, we are all human. We all have these, you know, but I think, you know, was there a time that you wouldn't have gone straight through?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yes, for sure. I mean, I think that, well, actually, I don't know. I mean, I think both things, like yes and no, because, you know, for a long time, being gay is something that like I compartmentalized because I felt like I had to.
Yeah.
So yes. Mm-hmm. And then no, because I'm a feeler.
Yeah.
So like you're going to know any emotion feeling like it is going to come out in full force. So
yeah,
I think both answers to that question.
Yeah.
I think it's also maturity, right? Like as we get older.
Yeah. Well, maturity and trial and error, right? Like I definitely tried to compartmentalize and fun fact, did not work. Do not recommend, 1 star. Doesn't work. I think it's just, I think it's so impressive that you just went head on with that. And you bring up another really important like component of your career, which was that, I guess, and I don't know, was it a moment where you felt, was there a moment where you decided that you wanted to live more fully? I think in one of your posts, you described it as living out loud as yourself in terms, because you had, and again, I'm cherry picking some quotes from other interviews that you've done, but I think that you described it as you had been quietly out and then decided that you wanted to step into that more fully. Was there a moment or was that more of an evolution for you?
Yeah, that's, it is. That's a perfect way to describe my experience is like, I am much better living out loud because I am loud.
You know? So it just aligns.
Yeah. It comes much more naturally to me than being quiet. I have a long tumultuous history with librarians, you know? So, yeah, it was definitely a process in terms of the first step was like coming to grips with my sexuality, like myself, you know, because I was looking around and I didn't have a lot of role models to be like, oh, this is a gay person. I mean, honestly, I did not. Mm-hmm. I was like grappling and you know, some of the only role models that I had were closeted. So that was actually like sending the opposite message than I needed at that moment. And so once I kind of came to terms with that and started dating women, then the next step was like, I don't feel like I can be my full authentic self in the cycling world. I mean, it was just as simple as that. Like I literally thought I had to make a choice between becoming an Olympian, you know, making my Olympic dreams come true and being gay. Ugh. And oh God, that is devastating in and of itself. And it's like I had this dream. And so you sacrifice everything for it. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it takes a village. So you need team support, you need sponsors, you need mechanics, you need soigneurs to give you massages. Like, what if none of those people would do that?
Right.
If they knew I was gay, you know, and what if I didn't get selected for a team because, you know, there was homophobia. So I had a real fear. I mean, a real fear, because I put in my life. This is my life's work. And then I feel like I'm going to need to throw it away if I come out. And so I lived under the radar. I mean, my friends and family knew I was out, and not my teams, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like kept it under wraps until I essentially met Frasier. And yeah, it was such like a beautiful evolution of love. I'm actually making this connection right now.
In oh, real great.
Time, but it was like,
welcome to our therapy session.
Yeah. Am I going to have to pay you for this? So, I mean, I think part of like true authentic love is feeling enough. Mm. Right. So yes. For one of the first times in my life, I felt enough, like just however I was that day, however I showed up, it's like, yeah, you're enough, Leah. Oh. And so I think part of that gave me the confidence to be like, yeah, I'm enough. Like, if I'm gay or not gay, this is me. So, and that kind of coincided with then, you know, fast forward a little bit of time after we met, then we got engaged in 2018. And so it was the lead up to us getting married, and Cliff Bar, this is the importance of representation. Mm-hmm. So my contact at the time in marketing at Cliff Bar is also gay.
Oh.
And so she knew mm-hmm. that I was gay and I was engaged. And so it came time for Pride Month and everyone's looking around the room and going, do we have any gay athletes? I don't think we do. And she raised her hand. You know, that's the importance of representation. Yes. This is the ripple effect.
Yes.
And she said, yeah, we do. We actually, Leah is going to get married this fall. And they said, great. Let's like throw her out there on social media and celebrate that. And for the first time, that aspect of myself was out there and it was celebrated.
Oh.
And that is such a powerful moment and gift for me, because then it gave me permission, like, oh my gosh, okay, my sponsors, like, this is not something to be fearful of, like, they're going to actually celebrate it.
That's amazing.
And yeah. And so that set me free, honestly. And I wanted to give that gift of freedom to others who may be grappling with the same thing. So it was very intentional to like, it was one of my missions on social media to like, okay, now I need to represent, I want to represent this. So to create more space and give visibility to like, yes, you can be gay. Yes, you can be an Olympian. And yes, you can be a sponsored athlete. Like, mm-hmm. have no fear. All of these things can exist.
That's incredible. I'm curious because I feel like that could have gone a couple of different ways, right? Looking yeah. around the room, do we have a gay athlete? It could have gone the direction of feeling exploited, but you felt celebrated.
Yes.
What do you think was the difference?
Ooh, that is a good question. I've never been asked that question. You're good at this.
Thank you.
You know, maybe it was because I was being represented in that room by a fellow gay female.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was more of a gift. Like, it felt real and authentic.
That, yeah, that makes total sense. And all of this, I think, is so heartbreaking and empowering at the same time that
yeah.
you put all of you into this Olympic dream, mm-hmm. and then the dream itself forced you into a position where you couldn't be you.
Yeah.
Until Frasier.
Yeah.
And she's yeah. like, yeah, you're enough. I mean, I got chills when you said that. I just,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was the dream, and it was more so a hostile cycling space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lacking representation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was it until you know, I'm at that point later in my career where I already have, you know, I already have two Olympics under my belt, mm-hmm. right? And I've already made that dream come true. And now I have this other affirming, you know, experience with Clif Bar and my other sponsors. And so it's like, okay, now I can be brave enough to come out like yeah. for real and be out loud about it. And it still takes, man, it still takes a lot of courage because it's like, I have to come out yeah. every day and I can like make the choice whether or not to do that. And in some spaces, I mean, you're like looking for signs, right? Like you're constantly scanning, like, is this a safe space for me? It's like, that's why those like signals of like, yeah, you put the pride flag or the trans flag, like on your, a name tag, or you know, I'm like looking for that flag, like in a neighborhood. It's like, is this a safe space for me? So
yeah
it still takes a little bit of courage when, especially when you're lacking those signals.
Yeah. Yeah. Big time. And so you got to a point in your career where you had established yourself and established a platform that you could then use to become, I mean, you kind of became the role model that you didn't have.
Yeah, totally. That was a mission.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a challenge that, I mean, it's not something that, you know, cis hetero folks really think about, is having to look for those safe spaces and check in the cycling space, especially mm-hmm. if this is a safe place for me. I mean, I feel like I've felt that way sometimes as a woman, but then also,
of course.
Yeah.
Yes. Of course.
That part. but yeah, like this is, you know, for a lot of folks, like it's, you know, visually, like if you're a different color, if you're a different size, like you don't,
yes.
you don't even get the choice of whether you want to disclose or not disclose, because it's right there for everybody to see and judge or include or yeah. not include. And,
absolutely.
Yeah. Frasier played this obviously massive role in your life, period, but also pivotal role in your career as an athlete. When you made your retirement announcement, you thanked so many people and you had so many people to thank. And I love that you had this beautiful village that you'd built around yourself to support you through this career. How did your village look at the end of your career versus at the beginning of your career?
That is such an interesting question that I have honestly never pondered. It, at the end of my career, it looked bigger, like for sure, because you don't know anybody,
yeah.
you know, at the beginning,
yeah,
you don't know anybody. So you're kind of like building and, you know, laying these bricks of this foundation and support village as you move through your career and meet everybody. I mean, I remember being at my first Seattle Classic with Trek VW on my first trade team and walking around the venue with Sue Haywood, who was like
a legend.
Yeah. yeah. And she was my mentor and my older teammate. I was very, very lucky to have her as an older teammate. And she knew everybody and she's introducing me. And I just remember thinking, how am I going to, first off, remember all these names? And then second off, like, how does she know so many people? And now I walk around Sea Otter and the same thing happens. You know, it's just like, hey. I mean, I can't walk 10 feet. You know, so you build community and you build a support network, I think, as we like progress and spend more time in the community. It's yeah. just like a natural thing.
We'll hear more from Leah after this quick break. If you appreciate what we're doing and want to support the show, you can support us directly through Patreon and Ko-Fi. Both Ko-Fi and Patreon enable you to help us cover production costs through memberships with perks, like access to bonus episodes, merch, and more. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi, as they don't take a fee. You can find it at ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Unlike Ko-Fi, Patreon takes an 8% fee.
That said, if you're already supporting other creators on Patreon, you can support us there too. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/beagoodwheel. That's patreon.com/beagoodwheel. For even more ideas on how you can support the show, check out beagoodwheel.com/support. That's beagoodwheel.com/support. If the idea of being a good wheel resonates with you, check out the Be a Good Wheel community at beagoodwheel.com/community. The community is a virtual, membership-based organization of like-minded folks keen to continue exploring what it means to be a good wheel beyond the podcast. Connect with other folks on topics that go way beyond the bike, toward meaningful application and fellowship across industries and aspirations. Fuel your curiosity and inspiration by joining today. Learn more and join us at beagoodwheel.com/community. That's beagoodwheel.com/community. And now back to our conversation with two-time Olympian and mountain biking superstar, Leah Davison. And another thing that you've mentioned, so I'm curious how you figured out what you needed, like what kind of support you needed in your village. Because one of the things that you've mentioned, and I've seen this in a few different interviews that I read with you, and I know this about you too, is how you know that you need different sports. Like, yes. You need to ski, you need to surf, you need to have these other sports integrated into your life experience in order for you to be the best athlete on the mountain bike that you can be, which is so interesting because from the outside looking in, somebody might look at that and say, oh, that's just, you know, that's a distraction. Why would you spend your time on a surfboard or on skis when you could be getting more miles on the bike? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about this for two reasons. One, that it works. Like, what is it about it that works for you? And two, how did you figure out that it worked for you and feel strong enough to be confident in that and not be swayed by somebody telling you like, oh, you should be spending more time on the mountain bike?
Yes. Guess and check. I mean, there were definitely times where I was like, well, maybe I should ride all winter, you know, like maybe that's the thing I should do. So I feel like in the cycling world, like everyone's different, right? So if you looked at, it would be so interesting to compare everyone's training on the Olympic long team.
Yeah.
Because it would all be different in ways, and in ways it would all be the same, right? And so I found that since I came into this sport at, you know, later in high school, and I was already heavily invested in skiing and ski racing and running and like a youth of growing up of doing all these different things, I love skiing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like my first love. And so I knew I needed something different. Because I would get burned out. Mm. You know, it takes so much work and I call them motivation matches, right?
Ooh.
Like you only have a finite amount of motivation matches during the season.
Yeah.
And it takes like strike one, threshold workout, you know, up a climb.
There it goes.
Maybe two, you know, the shootout in Tucson, the group ride. That's like a whole matchbox for me, you know, of stress. You know me. We met while road racing, and that is not my bread and butter.
Oh, man. Very stressful. Yeah.
So I learned in college, actually, I had torn my ACL downhill ski racing after my freshman year. And so I redshirted a season. And during that season, I learned how to Nordic ski. And I realized like, oh my, this is so hard. Like aerobically.
Yeah.
It's so hard. And so you can ski and go threshold or like those higher zones in your heart rate, just because it's full body, it's arms and legs versus just legs, and not burn motivation matches.
Yeah.
And so like that was a way for me to get really strong, like full body wise. So preventing injuries and really strong like aerobically. And then I would just need a period of time for it to transfer over to my legs, spinning in circles. So I learned that about myself. And because of that, like I would come into those like March races off the back. Mm-hmm. Off the back, because I'd be like, I'm so hot. I'm in winter. And I just like need like give me six weeks to like transfer this fitness over, and then I'll be there. And so that's something that I learned over the course of my career. And there were times where I was like, okay, maybe I should like go to Tucson in January. Mm-hmm. Like maybe that will work better. So we tried that and it didn't.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I like was not as strong, you know,
so interesting.
Like physically I was getting like little nags and aerobically I wasn't as strong, and I'm like, okay, I need skiing. Yeah. Like that works for me.
Yeah. And experimenting like that, I think is so valuable, because if you coming into those March races and you're off the back, mm-hmm. having the confidence and to know like, This doesn't mean I'm not the athlete I thought I was. This doesn't yes. mean I'm not going to have a good season, because it's so easy to have one bad race and all of a sudden you start doubting everything.
Yes.
Do you remember a time when you finally kind of got to that point where you were like, I know even if this is not a good race, like it's not going to shake my confidence?
Man, that is a good question. I don't know if there was a moment. I mean, did I deal with like some confidence shakes? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I would just think back and I would go, okay, I was on snow a week ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so like it's naturally going to take some time. And my coach would remind me of that. Mm-hmm. And then I think, you know, all it takes really is it working one time.
Ah, yeah.
I think, and being open to it working one time, and then you're like, yeah, this worked.
We got this.
And like keeping the faith. I mean, cycling is so brutal because it's such a long season. There are so many potential confidence pitfalls, like all along the way.
Yeah.
And now, especially that we have power meters, you know,
oh my gosh,
it can be a blessing and a curse.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like about, I think remaining open, that, you know what? We tend to like, catastrophize. Is that how you say that word?
Yeah. Yeah. Catastrophize. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, a great word.
It's just human nature, right? It's like, oh, this is the end of the season.
It's March.
This is the end of my career. I should probably just quit now. Right. And it's like, what if we just said, what if it is going to work out?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Because we always go to the opposite of that, right? Like,
always.
What if this means everything's, you know, everything's down the drain? But
yes.
Flip it around.
Yeah. But like, what if this is all part of the plan for it to work out?
Yeah. Well, I think that's such a common pitfall, especially with the seasonality of cycling. And for those who aren't familiar, typically the competition of the racing season doesn't really get going until March or April. And then it lasts for a really long time, all the way through September, October. So it's a really long season. But a lot of us, and I will include myself in this group because I have fallen into this trap myself, you come out into the very beginning of the season and you kind of feel like, if you're not in peak fitness in March, then somehow like, the whole season is going to just be terrible. But it's so ridiculous because you literally have like 6 or 7 months before, you know, like, but, and, yes. and the idea that you would, if you came out in March with peak fitness and be able, like that you would be able to sustain it through
yes.
the parts of the season that really matter is
yes.
ludicrous.
I mean, that's a disaster.
It is.
Essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you want to win the first race or do you want to win Worlds?
Right.
You know?
Yes.
It's like, I probably want to choose Worlds in like August, September. So I've just started coaching two athletes individually. And I feel like sometimes I give them that reminder of like, hey, by the way, it's January. I don't want our numbers to be good
right
now.
Yeah.
Like we're building, you know, we're building, but we are aiming for like July, August, even May. I mean, that's like a far ways away.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember who said it, and I apologize. I'm not going to be able to attribute this quote very well, but it's a great quote. Don't waste good legs on training.
Oh, God, that's brilliant.
Right.
I've never heard that.
I know. If anybody listening knows where that quote came from, I'll try to find it myself and we'll add it in the show notes if we can. But like, yeah.
Yes. Preach. Whoever said that.
So tell me about the coaching. How has that transition been for you from being a competitor to now coaching the competitors?
It has been really, really cool. Actually, it's been really rewarding. I retired a year ago and I set up this last year to explore three different things, three different paths. One being coaching, another public speaking, and another race broadcasting. So announcing, commentating. And there's a real fear after retiring from a 20-year career. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this because all retirements and change are essentially the same. It's scary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And especially coming off of an Olympic pursuit, I thought, is anything going to fill up my cup like that did? You know, it's really, yeah, I was scared, you know, and upset about it. And the great news is I liked all of them. So I got to answer that question. So that was a big win. And yeah. Coaching consistently comes out on top. I mean, I find it a natural transition for me because I was very invested in mentoring throughout my career, like the second half of my career. So yeah, coaching seems like a natural transition.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So how long did it take you to figure out that this was all working? Or did you kind of, was it sort of like a love at first sight with these three paths?
Wow. Well, there was one moment where I felt like that relief of like, oh my gosh, okay, I'm going to find there's something more for me on the other side. Mm. And that was, so I retired, my last race was August 23rd. It was Marathon Nationals. And then I'm so grateful for this. Tara McCarthy of USA Cycling said, hey, do you want to commentate the cyclocross nationals? I know you said you were interested in this. And I was like, yes, that's going to be great. And so that was like the beginning of December. And from that moment, when I retired, my back was killing me.
Oh.
I mean, it was like my body was finally let up and it was like, okay, now I can feel all the pain.
It's finally.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Like literally re-feeling all of these injuries. I'm not joking. Like, oh, I dislocated that elbow in 2005 and ow, this is hurting me now. It's like kind of wild.
Yeah.
The mind-body connection. And my chiropractor said, Leah, this is very normal. Like when my patients retire, usually at age 60, you know, or in their 60s, they all have back pain. Like this is a known and researched thing. And I thought, okay.
Wow.
So, and it was debilitating. Like I could walk, you know, and that's about it. And here I am like, yes, I'm retired. I want to do all these things like physically that I have not gotten to do. And now I can't do them because I'm reliving all these injuries that I've had. So I went into Cyclocross Nationals, Hartford, Connecticut. It was snowing. I'm the sideline broadcaster, or sideline reporter. So I'm standing out for 12 hours a day, interviewing, finish line interviews, side course interviews. And I went in and I thought, oh my, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to physically do this with my back. And then I get into it. I'm having a blast. Like it was awesome. And I'm on the car ride home and I think, oh my God, I haven't felt my back all weekend.
Whoa.
I haven't even thought about it.
Whoa.
And I thought, okay, like, because it was in that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, I can be at a bike race and participate in these moments that I love and honor them at the finish line, like honor these victories and know, like in my bones, what it takes to get that win.
Yeah.
And give and ask questions to like bring that experience out and honor it.
Oh my
gosh. I don't have to drool on myself and push my limits, you know, and I still know my name at the finish line. So it was such a cool new way to interact with bike racing. And I was like, my body literally was relieved. It was like, okay, there's something in this next chapter for me. Like, it's not all about the Olympics.
Yeah. It's like your body kind of stopped being stuck in the past.
Yes.
When you had this moment of realization that like, oh, there is hope for the future.
Yep.
That's
it's
amazing.
Kind of wild.
That is it's super wild.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have this platform now, right? Like you have established yourself as an athlete and you have established like, you know, USA Cycling was not blowing smoke when they were giving a nod to your legacy because you have done so much to pave the way for women on bikes, for gay athletes. I mean, it's really remarkable. And a lot of this is through your nonprofit, the Little Bellas. Mm. And we can talk a little bit more about that. But before we dig into Little Bellas, I want to talk more about this future looking direction of how you are using your platform now, how you want to use your platform. Like, how do you see, what do you want to do with all of this as you're moving forward?
Oh, I'm so excited. Yes. Yeah. So what a beautiful thing to have a platform to potentially make a difference. And now that I'm no longer functioning in this narrow space, which is the Olympic pursuit, because when you are pursuing an Olympic dream, you want, like I said before, you need sponsor support. You want to ride certain equipment, right? You want to do this, you want to do that. So I could not speak up as much as I wanted to, because I experienced these inequities, that homophobia, you know, like all of these ways that bike racing can break your heart.
Yes.
And especially if you're a woman, and especially if you're a gay woman. And, you know, you got to pick and choose. I had to be very careful. And so now that none of that matters, I can have these important conversations that will hopefully make an impact for the future and for women that follow, right? Mm. The athletes that follow, that's like, okay, it's going to be different, you know, and I'm ready to just grab any mic, you know, metaphorically or literally in my periphery and like, let's go, you know, like, because there is a lot of opportunity in the cycling space for change. And I want to use my voice and my experience and my platform to make it different. Like, it needs to be different for these younger women that are coming up through it.
Yeah. I mean, so many people could go through what you went through and feel embittered and like, okay, well, you know, I had to deal with all of this. So should you. But instead you're like, nope, I don't want anyone to have to deal with this. Like, let's.
Yeah. Cause this sucks.
This sucks. Yes. Yeah.
And sometimes it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And there are times where it's like, okay, I gotta take a pause. Like, I need to take care of myself, because it's almost like now that I've come out of functioning in that narrow space, I like pick my head up and I see like, oh my gosh, this is really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like sexism everywhere. And each of the paths that I chose, sexism, you know, and there's a lot of battles to be fought. So it's, I have learned, I mean, it's a balance, and you got to like fill up your cup so you can like fight those battles essentially.
Yeah. Cause it takes so much to show up for things like that and to show up and advocate for, you know, inclusion and just call it out. Just call out that sexism, that misogyny, that homophobia, because it's exhausting.
Yeah.
But we need people to show up. And I think you make a really good point that Oftentimes, well, the athletes that are in the middle of their racing careers, just like you were, don't necessarily feel like they have the freedom to speak up the way that they want to because they risk losing sponsors, losing team spots, which is, that sucks. sucks that it's like that.
It's a reality.
But it is a reality. And so you've got this really great position now where not only do you have the platform, but yeah, like you said, you don't have to worry about that stuff. Like,
yeah. And it's calling it out, the bad and the good.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And picking and choosing, there is still like some strategy, right? Of like, this is probably a battle not worth fighting. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really need to have this conversation. And there's a lot of things like, it's like forwards and backwards, right? Like simultaneously, there's a tug. The thing that in the past year that was very, I think heartening, I would use the word, is the Lifetime Grand Prix. And they are put, this is a series that is powered by women, mm-hmm. actually. And they are centering this on women. Like it, the women aren't the sideshow, right? Like right. we have equal coverage in the Call of the Lifetime. And they make sure, like at Big Sugar, there were three female broadcasters.
Wow. Three. Wow.
And they made sure like that they asked me to all of the events, right? And so it's like, that's actually huge mm-hmm. in the cycling world because we still deal with a World Cup where there has never been a female voice for cross country racing.
Wow.
There's never been a female voice. And that was my goal. I mean, it drives me nuts that there is not a female perspective. And like the women's racing is awesome.
It is.
So why don't,
it's so good.
Yeah. So why don't we have a female broadcaster?
Yeah.
And so that was one of my goals is like, I am going to broadcast a mountain bike World Cup.
Heck yeah.
And I essentially kicked the door down. I mean, that's what it took me. And I grabbed the mic. And then they said, thanks, Leah, you are great. Okay, the women's race is done. We don't need you anymore. And I go, oh, yeah? And so then I went over to my friends in the announcing booth who are awesome. And they're like, Leah, come announce with us. Great. I picked up that mic. So I'm like on a mission, you know, like if you're not going to let me pick up that mic, I'm going to pick up this one.
I love it.
And continue to give female voice a perspective.
What would you say to, let's say, athletes that are, you know, either in the middle of a pro career or aspiring to be professionals who want to pick up a mic and want to start advocating? What are some things that you think that you learned or that you feel like would be helpful or effective?
Yeah, your platform is impactful. No matter how small or big or how many followers you have or not. I mean, your platform is not only Instagram, right? It's who you mentor, who you choose to interact with and have these conversations. So it's never too early or too late to start to kind of dig into what matters to you and give it voice. And I would say align yourself with companies and organizations who you share values with.
Yeah.
And if you don't, get out of there because it's going to kill your soul.
Yeah.
And whatever kills your soul does not make you fast.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's not worth it. Which brings up a fantastic hashtag that you have. And this might be a little bit of a tangent, but it's so worth it. Happiness is fast. Like,
yes,
I feel like by now in this interview, people are going to get what you mean by that. But talk, tell me, like, when did you come up with that and like turn it into like the official happiness is fast hashtag?
Yeah, that was actually, I have to give credit to, there was like a happiness is fast predecessor. And that was someone making t-shirts that said, happiness watts are real.
Mara Kinsella.
Yes, there we go.
Yep. I remember that. Yeah.
I love Mara. Like, let's make those t-shirts again.
Yeah, I know. Right?
Because I love, that's my favorite t-shirt, honestly. And it had an ice cream cone and it was like, happiness watts are real. And I was like, this is one of my approaches to professional bike racing.
Yes.
And then when those t-shirts, she stopped making those t-shirts and the website. And so then I started this hashtag happiness is fast, because I think it's a great concept that essentially she started and that needs to live on.
Yes. Yes. There's, I think it's so easy to imagine that all, you know, top athletes are like these, you know, ascetic monks, you know, living lives of deprivation, yes, and, you know, discipline as misery. And in fact, when you talk to like an athlete like you, who's had a career for 20 years, like, you don't perform at the World Cup level for 20 years if you're miserable.
Yep. Preach. That's it.
So if how did you do that?
Fun.
Yeah. How did you integrate fun? Because you have to do the work, right? Like that part, yes, like that's real. That's legit. But how did you mix it up? How did you keep the fun in there?
It was mostly maple soft serve ice cream after motor pace sessions. Honestly. I mean, my coach and I would do a really hard motor pace session, whether it be like an hour, 3 hours, and then we would end at Palmer Lane and like have a maple creamy. That's what we call maple soft serve in Vermont. It was delicious. I mean, that's just like one of the ways. Another is like, we travel all around, and most of the time, I mean, people think, oh, it's so glorious. You know? It's like
the glamour life, jet setting. And
I mean, it makes me laugh just to think about it that way. It's like, oh yeah, you try to perform at an elite level after being jet lagged and on a plane for like 17 hours.
Having had to like build and break down your bike 4 times.
Yes, yes. And like sleeping, sitting up, you know, with like a neck grip. It's taking those moments, you know, because a lot of them are training, you're resting in the hotel room, but like taking those moments to like experience the places where you travel. And mm-hmm. Oh, exactly, a thumbs up. Those things are so funny now. If you can't see this, you know, this Zoom just gave us I gave a thumbs up. So that means we're on the right path.
Right. Leah literally did a thumbs up, and then the screen popped up with a thumbs up emoji. It was fantastic. You gotta come over to the YouTube channel and watch this.
Yep. There we go. Is there anything more to say? Yeah. So a lot of the ways I did that is taking those like travel days, maybe going and checking out Prague for an afternoon, or, and also experiencing like the cultures through food. That's my most favorite one.
I love that. And so one of the things that I remember this very clearly, I'm pretty sure I ordered one, was you designed a donut give up jersey for Garneau, and phenomenal. I'm donuts were part of how I incorporated happiness.
Yes.
So I just love that. Can you tell me the story behind coming up with that, the donut give up jersey?
Yeah, Garneau is such a cool sponsor. I've been working with them for now a long time. I mean, it's just a little bit under a decade. And Heidi Myers was my sponsor contact at the time. We were great friends. And in fact, she's one of the people that encouraged me to like live more out loud.
Aww.
Like, Leah, I think you being more visible on Instagram with Fraser, I think it can make a real impact. And I'm forever grateful for that conversation. So she was like, yeah, let's do something to showcase our custom program that you can make any kit that you want to with like our awesome designers. And so we went off the donut theme, and she's like brilliant. So I think she came up with the donut give up. And I'm like, I love it. Let's like cover a kit in donuts. This is great.
I love it. And that's a great segue, because you also recently did a kit with them for Allied, right?
Yes.
Athlete Ally.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that kit went with my Allied Cycle Works custom bike. So mm-hmm. they make custom paint schemes, which are stunning. Mm-hmm. And I was already thinking about in my last season of racing, like, okay, I'm going to race pick organizations that I believe in, Athlete Ally being one of them, and I'm going to design kits to raise awareness for these organizations, hopefully money. And so I was thinking Athlete Ally is creating a world where everyone can access the life-saving power of sport.
Yeah.
And so in particularly using sport as to build a more inclusive world through sport and focusing on the LGBTQ plus population. So It's a wonderful organization. Go check them out. And so with that, it was kind of a coming out kit. Essentially, it was called Darkness to Light. Mm-hmm. So it was about coming out of the darkness and into the light of living my full authentic self and life. And in a way, I mean, everyone was coming out of the darkness of the pandemic and kind of coming more into the light. Yeah. We all had our own versions of darkness. So when Allied came to me in our first meeting and they said, "Oh, Leah, what do you want to paint your first bike?" And I was like, "What? This is awesome." I had no idea I could design my own bike, my own paint scheme. It's incredible. So I said, yeah, let's do this concept of darkness to light. So it's on the front. It's riding straight into the darkness. It's like a dark blue night sky. Mm. And then it transitions to a lighter blue. And then it's in the rear, it's the light. It's almost like this, it's not a pink, but I can't remember the word, but I love that color. And nice. So it's a sick bike. And it also looks like one of those popsicles. That's the red, white, and blue, which is, yes. I also love. They're yes. my favorite.
What are they? Rocket Pops? Or I know, yeah, I know exactly.
Bomb Pops, yes. Rocket Pops. So awesome. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So we did a matching kit with Garneau and this bike, and I rode this bike at Unbound.
Oh.
So that was I was running into a lot of darkness there.
Yeah,
200 miles.
Unbound is a 200-mile gravel race. And for those unfamiliar, first of all, 200 miles is just stupid long. Stupid long, full stop. But then you add to that it's 200 miles on gravel. And then it's ridiculously stupid long. But then you're on gravel in Emporia, Kansas, which is not normal gravel.
No.
I've been on gravel roads in Vermont that are better than the paved roads here in Connecticut.
Yes.
The gravel in Emporia is chunky and brutal. So this is 200 miles of chunky, brutal gravel.
God. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And then it poured rain.
Oh, so then you have
to
run.
So it was funny. I liked that a little bit better. Right. Being a mountain biker. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a challenge.
So lots of darkness. So this was part of your transition out of World Cup racing, right? Doing the Lifetime Grand Prix. What was that like for you going from, I mean, obviously you're carrying a ton of fitness, right? Coming into this kind of racing, which is a little bit, maybe I'll say more fun. Is that a fair way of putting it? Then maybe?
Debatable.
Maybe not the right word. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you go. You go.
I am optimized for 90 minutes of racing.
There you go.
90 minutes.
Yeah.
And Unbound, which is at the extreme end of this race calendar, which is the Lifetime Grand Prix, took me 12 hours to finish. And so I'm just not made for that. I'm not made for that endurance events. I discovered through this year of racing that I kind of max out at 3.5 to 4.5. I can race, right?
Yeah.
Up until that point, put in attacks and digs. And that for me is fun.
Right.
And then after that, the lights shut off and it is survival mode. Not as fun.
Not as fun.
Yes. So that's what I discovered in that year of racing. I also went into it thinking I love all forms of bike racing.
Right.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Mountain biking, and because I've done some road racing and gravel. And then I was like, oh no, I don't. I like mountain biking. I really like mountain biking. I mean, gravel is great, but it was just a little bit long for me.
Yeah. 200 miles is a little bit long for me.
Yes. Yes.
I think that's pretty fair to say. Yeah. But I mean, it's great. Like, it's wonderful confirmation, you know, bookending this career that like, I chose the right path.
Yeah, totally. I definitely chose the right path.
Oh, so let's talk a little bit about Little Bellas, because I don't want to end this conversation without at least, I mean, because this has been an organization that you and your sister, Sabe, founded together. And I mean, you've been changing lives with Little Bellas for a really long time. So let's just, do you mind just giving the audience a quick overview of what it is and what you guys have been doing with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So my sister and I, Sabe, we got together with this other woman, Angela Irvine, and the three of us started Little Bellas. And Angela is a little bit older, so she kind of served as our mentor through the whole process, which is beautiful because it is, Little Bellas is a mentoring on mountain bikes program for girls. And we started in Vermont. It has grown to be all over the country, multiple chapters, which meet, I mean, there's many different formats, but our bread and butter is meeting weekly for about 6 weeks for 2 hours. It could be 4 weeks, 6 weeks session, once a week. And it's an incredible thing that we are powered by our mentors, our volunteer mentors and our chapter leads around the country. They're the ones that make the Little Bellas dreams come true, you know, like, and really enact our mission and this whole vision we had, which was to get more girls on bikes and also to use the bike as a tool that it can be as to gain self-confidence and empower women. And it's really amazing that, you know, Sabe has been at the lead of it as the executive director, and she's just taken Little Bellas to some incredible places. So her working together with the staff and all of our program leads, and we probably have now, I would say like around 600 volunteer mentors around the country. So not only does it give, it's a really neat program for girls like 7 to 14 years old. It also gives a very wonderful space for women, these female mentors, to meet each other.
Yeah.
And like, it's just a lovely female space in cycling.
You guys have been building community. I know, definitely in Vermont and across the country at this point.
Yeah.
What's one of the things that surprised you most about this process of building communities?
I think it's easier than you think. I mean, this term like building community is like all, you know, all around and gets like thrown out. And I think, I mean, let's be clear. The work of Little Bellas and the mentors and everything, that is very hard work. Yeah. And so when the infrastructure is there and it's built right, like the bones are built right, which is what the Little Bellas program does, then if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. And it's about making connections, really.
Yeah.
It's about making connections. That's what building community is to me.
Yeah. And it seems like you're creating, so Little Bellas is kind of creating the structure and making the space for people to find the belonging that they haven't had.
Yes, exactly.
In cycling.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. We try to make it, you know, the staff, we're based in Vermont, and we try to make it easy for these women who want to start a program like Little Bellas. Like, I would love to get girls together to ride. You know, I have a daughter, or I have a, you know, like, or I just want to do this because I feel passionate about it. And so our job at the organization's job is to make it easy for those program leads. And so it's just kind of a plug and play. And then they get to add their own little take and creativity to it, right? Like, we learn so much from the program leads around the country because everyone is different. So they bring something new and we're like, oh yeah, that works really well. Let's use this over here, or that works. Yeah, we should change that. So yeah, it is such a really cool community.
Yeah. Yeah. So if I understand correctly, though, Little Bellas is not about racing.
No, not at all. Yeah, that's the other point I wanted to make. So it is a non-competitive program, and we get competitive girls that come along and participate and get on bikes, and they love it. Mm-hmm. And of course, we encourage them to race if they want to. And we found that it's a space for those girls who reach, you know, 10 years old, 11, 12, and they don't really vibe with the team sport model.
Yes.
And they're in the process of getting left behind, right? Like, okay, if I don't play soccer, I don't really want to do this, or none of my friends are doing this, so I'm not going to do it. We have successfully built a space where they feel like they can be part of the team, right? Mm-hmm. And have a sense of belonging. So that's a big reason why we do jerseys for the program. And so it's like, it's an equalizer, right? Like everyone shows up with the Little Bellas jersey, everyone is equal. Mm-hmm. So it partially throws like those judgments that people can have out the window, because I have a Little Bellas jersey, I belong.
I belong here. Oh,
yeah.
I love that. I wanted to follow up on that thought, because I think it breaks my heart, because I see this happen a lot in, especially in the school systems, where there are, and to be fair, I mean, schools are not in a position to offer all of the things. Like, there's limitations, and I totally understand that. But I think it's so heartbreaking when kids have a bad experience, or they don't vibe with, you know, what's offered in PE classes, physical education classes, or they don't vibe with whatever the club sports are on offer. And they just think, oh, exercise is not for me. Movement is not for me. Like, I've tried this thing, it doesn't work for me, or I don't fit, I don't belong here, this is not for me. When there's something out there, right, that will vibe, whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be. And I love that you are offering this alternative where people can find, kids especially, can find joy in movement and belonging while they do. I mean,
yes,
that's a dream, right?
Yeah, it is. Another thing that I've realized through this past year, and I read this book, Good for a Girl by Laura Fleischman. Have you read this?
It's on my list. I can't wait to read it.
I highly recommend it. It's a lot. It's, you know, like parallel, in some ways, parallel stories. And it's pretty eye-opening that she gave words to some realizations that I've had over this past year, which is sport and cycling is designed for and built by men.
Yeah.
And, you know, Title IX has been great, like a game changer in a lot of different ways for you and I,
for sure,
and our generation and the generation before, because my mom had zero opportunities to compete, which is one of the reasons why she threw my sister and I in all the different sports. And in a way, it sets up, like, we are trying to fit in the system that's been built by men and designed for men.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, sometimes you run up to like a square peg in a round hole, like, this isn't working.
Right.
And there's a lot of assumptions around the systems that have been built, you know, and one of them is that there's a pervasive notion that women can't coach. Women aren't as good of coaches as men because there's no women coaches out there. Mm-hmm. So if there are none, how are we supposed to change this narrative, right? And it is a narrative that is out there. I mean, I experienced coaching in the last year. There was some feedback. This is when it really crystallized for me. There was some feedback from some of the riders on the national team, which was, and I do not fault them for this. Mm-hmm. You know, Leah is awesome. And I wish we had a male version of Leah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And that at first stung. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, no, I'm not a dude. And guess what? There is no male version of me.
Yeah.
This is as good as it gets. Like, if you go searching for a male version, you're not going to find anything better.
There is only one Leah Davison, folks.
Yes. And then I kind of, after like that calmed down, settled, then I realized, you know what? I get it. Mm-hmm. I understand where that came from, that comment, because guess what? I wish I had a female coach at any point in my career.
Yeah.
At any point. And so we as women are just, we have to sit there and take it because yeah. there are no women coaches out there.
Yeah.
There's like a extreme lack of female coaches. And so it's like, man, I wish I had a woman, but okay, we're going to make it work with this guy because I want to go with the Olympics mm-hmm. to the Olympics, yeah. you know, yeah. like, and I'm talking like, and I'm not saying male coaches are bad. There
no.
are a lot of phenomenal coaches out there.
100%.
And it's just so interesting that the one moment where there wasn't a male coach and they only had female coaches to work with, they got uncomfortable. And it was like, no, we need a guy.
Yeah.
And it's like, welcome to my life. For my Forever. Entire career.
Yes. Yes.
And the reaction from the organization was like, we got to get a guy. We got to get a guy. And it's like, no.
Like, wait a minute.
Why?
Wait a minute.
And so it's like, pause. This is designed for and by men. Because the guys experience a little bit of discomfort and we got to, oh my God, we got to fix it. Mm-hmm. And so what happens in sport when, if we started to center women, what would that look like?
Oh man.
It would look like female coaches. It would look like prioritizing support systems around women. It would look like a diagnosis for red S, mm-hmm. which by the way, men and women can get. Yep. So that would benefit, you know, both genders. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a good thing to ponder. Like, what would that start to look like?
Oh my gosh, the research, the populations that we include in research studies on performance physiology, you know?
Like, yes.
Let's stop excluding the women because of their menstrual cycle and maybe study yes. what's going on with that.
Like, we would love to know.
Yeah.
We would love to know.
We're all ears.
Yeah. There are some like little pockets of research, and I'm sure you know, like I just heard about this Red S study of the Western States marathoners.
Oh,
so
wow.
like they had a population from Western States, ultra marathoners, men and women sign up. And so there's some pretty interesting findings being published from that. And then Whoop, the head of data analytics and science, is a woman.
Oh, there you go.
And she yeah. actually gave a phenomenal TED talk in the same cohort that I did on the anniversary of Title IX.
Oh.
And I would highly recommend, I'll send you the link, but her talk is phenomenal.
We can include that in the show notes. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. What you're saying is really resonating. And one of the things I came to realize shortly after retirement and reflecting back yeah. on my career was I was like, wow, you know, so I started swimming at about the age of 10. Mm. And so I was a swimmer kind of through adolescence, and then cycling was like my second act. And I was like, oh my gosh, from the age of 10 through my whole career, I was pushing against or feeling ashamed of everything that makes me a woman.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And I was striving for all of the male versions of that. So I wanted muscles, not curves. Like, curves are bad, muscles are good.
Yep.
You know, and these things are not, it's not necessarily true. Like, yes, I need to be strong and I need to be fit in order to compete. But what my strength and my fitness looks like as a woman doesn't have to look the same as it does for men. But when I was growing up, from the age of 10,
Man.
I hated the parts of my body or the things about myself that we would traditionally consider feminine, right?
Yep.
And I was cultivating all of the characteristics that we would traditionally ascribe to males. Because that was, and what does that do to you on a fundamental level when you are constantly rejecting what is fundamentally you?
Yeah.
And trying to be something different.
Yes.
And that's not to say that we can't all embody different male and female, you know, the characteristics we traditionally ascribe to male and female.
Yeah.
But what you were talking about having a female coach, it's not about, you know, it's not necessarily that a female coach is going to be better, but there are going to be some things where I could say to you, Leah, you know, I describe in 5 words and immediately you're going to be like, oh, I've been there. I totally get it. It's like we can kind of transmit that information in shorthand. And yes, because you've had that experience as a woman, we're just like right there. Okay, I get you. You don't have to explain yourself anymore. Let's handle this. Whereas with, if I'm saying the same thing to a male coach, I mean, it might take so much explanation and we might never get to that point of understanding. And that might be something that would make a really big difference for me as an athlete.
Yeah. Did you ever have a few, so you're talking swimming and you swam for Stanford, correct?
Yep.
So this is like a high level D1 and then through your cycling career. Did you ever have a female coach?
I did. So when I was in high school as a swimmer, I did have a female coach. And I think that she kind of softened a lot of this for me, even though she had been through it herself. But even her influence wasn't enough to stave off the tsunami of influence in sport. And then
the rhetoric,
right? Yeah. The rhetoric, the entire culture, you're just steeped in it all the time. I mean, this is going to sound awful, but at one point, this was like years later, I was telling a friend a quote unquote, air quotes, funny story about how a team I was on, the staff hired a prostitute during one of our race series. And I was telling this woman about it and her jaw hit the floor and she looked at me and she's like, that is not okay. And I stopped myself and I realized I had been sharing this as if it were just a funny anecdote.
Yes.
And it drove home to me how deeply I had normalized the misogyny in our culture to think that that was acceptable and funny when we're on a team of women who are literally between the ages of like 18 and 30. Yeah. How is that okay? It's not okay. And that, I mean, you know, that's one among many, many, many things. But and then I did have a female coach for a short period, in cycling, and that did help. It did help. But again, it wasn't enough because again, the whole culture, it was like, okay, my coach is female, but my director's male, my whole staff is male. All of our swan years and massage therapists are male.
Yes.
And not that any of those are they're not necessarily bad people. I mean, we'll table the discussion of the staff.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, that staff.
That's really bad. But I mean, there are good people everywhere. So like, this is not to say that like, this is all bad, but to your point, the representation matters because having a female coach makes a difference. Yes. And then having a female director, or even if it's just one person on the staff, or even having equal representation on the staff, you know, 50-50 would be amazing. Like, and then you have the valuable, because men bring valuable perspective and women do too. And we need both.
Yeah.
But it's, there's a lot, we have a long way to go with that representation.
Yeah. And just thank goodness there's Safe Sport now. I mean, the first time I took Safe Sport, I was like, oh my goodness. You just think back to your career like all of these awful moments, you know? And it's like, well, now at least there's like some kind of infrastructure and support system to like deal with that. But that's just like one of the many barriers for women's sports, like abuse of all different kinds, emotional, sexual, physical,
verbal,
inequality, you know, unequal pay, unequal race opportunities, unequal hiring. I mean, let's not even get into like, when women get pregnant, do their contracts stay? There's just so the red S. Mm-hmm. Like, this idea that power to weight ratio is everything.
Yes.
And that you need to like starve yourself, you know? And if you don't get your period, oh, okay, whatever. You know, like I'm performing. It's like, no, you need to get your period. Like this is essential for your performance and food is fuel. And it's like, there are so many barriers in women's sports that do not need to be there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Because the part of sport is embracing challenge.
Yes.
And overcoming. But there are challenges which are genuinely fulfilling.
Yes.
And contribute to growth. And then there are, as you just put it, these completely unnecessary challenges that are just barriers to the fulfilling challenges, to the challenges that make sport the beautiful thing that it is. Like, let's get over there.
Yes. Please. Let's go over there. Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's the goal. That's the goal.
And here's Leah. She is on a mission, picking up mics. Like,
yes.
Be careful if you've got a microphone and Leah's around. Honestly, hand it to her.
Just let's make this easy. And just hand it to me. You drop it, I'll pick it up, you know?
I love it. Okay, and that's the point where we say mic drop. And then we end the episode, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Well, before we go, because I don't want to, I could talk to you for the rest of the day, but before we go, this is the Be a Good Wheel podcast. So is there, and I know, because I saw your retirement thank you, and there's such a long list of folks that I know you would, that are going to be spinning around in your head, but is there somebody that you want to just shout out off the top of your head who's been a really good wheel for you in your career?
Oh, man. Yeah. Okay, there's a couple.
Okay. Okay.
Frazier, obviously, one of the best wheels out there.
Yeah.
And then Andy Bishop, my coach, he is a really good wheel to follow in the pack, literally and metaphorically. And also Bill Knowles. I mean, he is my strength coach. He has brought me back from two hip surgeries, one knee surgery, and then two Olympics and two world championship podiums. So just absolutely unbelievable. And I could not have made it to where I did without my family support. I mean, my parents let me live with them until I was 30 and they've supported me from day one. Like, yep, Leah, go get your ass out the door, train and like, go do what you can do. This is such a great opportunity. So yeah, those would be only the starting. Off the top of my head, the good wheels.
It's an iceberg, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. I understand. Well, Leah, you have been a great wheel for me personally.
Oh,
thank you. And I know that you've been a good wheel for so many people, not just through the Little Bellas, but through everything that you've done as a trailblazer and a role model. So thank you for all of that. And thank you for joining us today on the show.
Man, thanks for having me. And thank you for being a good wheel for me.
Aw, thank you. I love how openly Leah shares the very real and raw parts of her story. I'm grateful to her for sharing so openly with all of us. And I got chills when she shared how Frazier's unconditional love is what helped her finally feel enough. Sometimes part of what can drive our aspirations is that fear of not being enough. And one of the many things I love about Leah's story is how finally feeling enough did anything but diminish her drive. Instead, it was feeling enough that helped her unlock even more of her potential. I also really appreciate and admire how Leah is determined to make things better for other athletes. She understands that some challenges in sport are important, fulfilling, and essential to an athlete's growth. And others, like abuse, inequality, and discrimination, should play no part of an athlete's journey. And she is doing something about it. I felt so fired up after speaking with Leah. And if you do too, nurture that fire. Find others. Rally them too. And every chance you get, pick up that mic. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you loved today's show, remember to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. The Be a Good Wheel podcast is produced by our wizard behind the curtain, Maxine Philibong. Find all published episodes and sign up for our newsletter at beagoodwheel.com. You can also listen wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the show comes entirely from listeners like you. Support us on Ko-Fi and Patreon to get monthly Q&A episodes, official Be a Good Wheel merch, and more. You can submit questions for Q&A episodes at beagoodwheel.com. We encourage you to check out our page on Ko-Fi. Unlike Patreon, Ko-Fi doesn't take a fee, so 100% of your support goes to the show. Go to ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. That's ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/beagoodwheel. Learn more about how to support us at beagoodwheel.com/support. Until next time, thanks for listening, and thanks for being a good wheel.